Christians helped raise more than $300,000 for the Salvation Army. Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. The NBA last night, the Bucks and Bulls both off. The Bucks host the Bulls tonight at the Bradley Center. NFL Thursday Night Football, Denver beat Indianapolis 25-13. Coming up on Sunday, the Packers play Carolina. A noon start. Will Aaron Rodgers play? We'll find out. The Bears and Lions, they meet each other Saturday afternoon. That is a 3:30 game. In the NHL, the Blackhawks beat Winnipeg 5-1. They're off tonight. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday the 15th. Cloudy, windy, and cold. Chance of morning flurries. Today's high 28. And we could see wind gusts up to 30 miles per hour today. Tonight, sunset 418, cloudy and 26. Quick check on the weekend. Saturday, cloudy for the morning, partly sunny and seasonal for the afternoon, a high of 38. Sunday, cloudy, 30% chance of a rain snow mix, 39 degrees, the high on Sunday. Here are the current numbers. Wind is from the west at 14. It is 24 degrees. Wind chill stands at 12 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 12 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing about a wonderful brand new children's book about Christmas, about Santa. In part two of today's program, with Jessica DeBoer, I'll be talking about this weekend's Sing-Along Messiah coming up on Sunday evening. Stay with us. In the lives of most families, there comes a very tender and potentially difficult moment when the truth about Santa perhaps must be shared with a young child who begins to wonder exactly where do some of those presents come from that appear as if by magic under the tree, apparently from Santa. What does a parent do when you get to that point with a child where they begin to wonder? And of course, in some cases, that moment sort of comes and without a lot of fanfare, the child simply one day seems to step through a doorway into a new understanding that those presents come from mom and dad. And then there are other cases, though, where that shift is much more difficult, much more delicate, and parents are really confronted with maybe how to answer potentially awkward questions about who is Santa? Is there a Santa? There is a brand new book just published that could very well serve as a helpful guide and tool, so to speak, for a parent who finds themselves in such a situation. A book called Love Santa, with a subtitle that I think is lovely: When You're Ready to Share the Beautiful Truth About Santa. The book is the product of an award-winning children's book author by the name of Martha Brokenbro. And the book actually stems out of something which she wrote and shared with the world, and it stirred up such enthusiasm that the decision was made for this to be transformed into a lovely book, which is also also distinguished by the lovely illustrations of Lee White. I'm very excited to have Martha Brokenbro with me on the phone to talk about this, her latest book, again titled Love Santa. Martha Brokenbro, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to be speaking with you. Ahead of us talking about this specific book, Love Santa, I think it would really be fun if our listeners could find out a little bit about where you come from, and in particular, sort of the life's journey that's taken you to where you are now in this wonderful world of children's books.
Well, I've had such a wonderful life and a wonderful life's journey. I've wanted to write children's books since I was a child myself. I had a special teacher in third grade who encouraged me to write, and it took me a long time to find the courage to start. And it wasn't until I was 30 and had my first daughter, Lucy, who shares the name of the protagonist in this book, that I found the courage to begin. And, you know, I did a whole bunch of other things. I was a journalist. I was a teacher. I wrote game questions for Cranium and Trivial Pursuit. But this, writing books for children, is the work of my life. And this particular book came out of questions my daughter asked me. So Lucy was in second grade when I call it the Great Tooth Fairy Malfunction. The Tooth Fairy used to write little tiny notes to my children, not just when they lost teeth, but when the Tooth Fairy was concerned that they weren't brushing and flossing enough. And one of those notes from the Tooth Fairy I left open on my computer. I was tired, and I failed to close it, and the kids saw it, and they asked, is the Tooth Fairy real? And of course, I wanted to say, oh, yeah, she just uses my computer. We have a deal. But they weren't buying it. And so I knew at that point that the questions about Santa would come later. And so I started thinking about what my answer was going to be. And I remembered something that one of my high school teachers said to us at our graduation. He was this wonderful teacher, a wonderful writer. And the end of his speech told us to have faith. And he said, in what? That's for you to decide. And so a lot of my early adulthood has been the question of, what do I believe in? And so when Lucy asked, Mom, are you Santa? It was a time for me to tell her what I believe in. And of course, the answer and why we construct this Santa narrative is to show that there is magic in the world that we can believe in, and that we create it for ourselves and for each other. Hmm. And that's been my challenge to Lucy, is now that she's on Santa's team, go create some magic in the world for others. And it's been amazing to watch her do that. The next year, she raised $1,000 to buy toys for kids stuck in Seattle's Children's Hospital over the holidays. And this year, I think she did the greatest thing of all. She recorded a holiday album, and she even wrote an original song called Santa is Love, and that's to raise money to buy clean water and sanitation services to some of the world's poorest people.
Mm. Doesn't get much better than that, and how proud you must be.
I'm so, you know, like all parents, I'm so proud, and, you know, we've had our struggles, but there are really good moments too, and I think those are the ones that we can celebrate and build, especially at this time of year.
So explain how you shared this story that you just recounted sort of with the outside world, because that's a big part of how this book, Love Santa, ultimately has been published. How did you first share this story, at least in sort of its initial form, with the world?
Well, it started small. My daughter, when she was in third grade, and I had a letter journal. We would write letters back and forth to each other. And in one of those letters, she asked, Mom, are you Santa? So I wrote my reply and said, no, I'm not. There is no one Santa, and so on. And at the time, I was blogging for an online calendar company. And so I thought, hey, I like this. I'm just going to put it up on the blog. And I did. And it immediately went viral. People were pinning it on Pinterest, sharing it on Facebook. The next year, it happened even more. And so for a period of years, this letter, you know, it was picked up by the New York Times online parenting section. I know it's been translated into French and into Romanian, and it made its way around the world. I never thought it would be a children's book. These picture books have a really specific format, and, you know, it's not one where there's, you know, here's this question from a daughter and an answer from a mom. But it occurred to me after some discussion with friends that really a series of letters would turn it into something that becomes a story, that shows a child growing up over a period of years and a parent watching and waiting and being there to help transition the kid from innocence into experience.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Martha Brokenbro about her latest book, which is a beautiful children's book called Love Santa, which in a sense is a way in which a parent, by giving this book to a child who's ready to learn this, might come to kind of a new understanding about who Santa is and what Santa Claus represents. When you first answered that question from your own daughter, what kinds of things did you think about in terms of how best to answer that question? What were you anxious not to say? What were you anxious to say and how to say it? And how difficult was it to come up with the final answer that you ultimately shared with her, which, as we've already said, is kind of the kernel for this book we're talking about today?
Well, I've been thinking about my answer for a long time. And, you know, a lot of parents really wrestle with the idea of Santa in the first place. And our family is no different. My husband is Jewish, and so there was even the interfaith challenge. And for me, Santa, some parents are really hardline, like, no Santa. Santa's a lie, and I would never lie to children. And I, you know, I believe that Santa's a story, and stories teach us something, and they give us capacity to believe in things. And the Santa story in particular gives us the capacity to believe in magic and wonder and joy. And, you know, to give someone a gift that they need, I can't think of much that's really more beautiful than that. And so for me, the Santa story is an opportunity to build in our kids a sense of wonder and joy, and also a sense in giving to others, particularly those in need. And we've been doing this with Lucy since she was tiny. You know those trees where they hang an ornament and you know, there's a gift on it that a child needs? And so when she was about 4 years old, she picked one, and it was a warm jacket. And so she's like, this is for a cold girl. And, you know, we talked about the cold girl, and I just love how she, you know, made it the very most simple thing. A warm coat is for a cold girl. And the next year we adopted the whole cold family. And, you know, this was how we taught her that give to the world and look out for people who are in need. And there's all sorts of gifts. They're not just material gifts. You know, sometimes it's gifts of time. Sometimes it's gifts of your talent. And so this has been a useful story and a teaching tool.
Mm-hmm. One of the loveliest things about the book visually, besides the illustrations of Lee White, which I want us to take a moment to talk about, is the fact that as you tell the story of this little girl named Lucy, beginning from the age of five and then proceeding through the next several years of her life until she starts to sort of shift her thoughts about Santa, we actually have affixed to the page an envelope in which one finds and can pull out and read the latest letter that little Lucy has written to Santa, which is just a brilliant idea. Was that your idea? And for instance, how difficult was it to figure out exactly what these little letters from Lucy to Santa should say?
The idea of the letters, the pull-out letters, was not my idea. That was actually the idea of one of the youngest people working at Scholastic. She was then an editorial assistant. Her name's Kate, and she's really a creative genius. Her mom also writes children's books, so there's a long family tradition of it. My manuscript that I sent to my editor did have those letters, and what I wanted each of the letters to show was a child's curiosity. Children are wonderfully curious about the world, and they ask such good questions. And I also wanted to show the questions changing in nature as she got older.
Exactly.
And, you know, because I do think that, they do, you know, kids ask first about, you know, practical things, and then they, you know, get interested in the more philosophical things. And then finally she asks for the truth, "Dear Mom, are you Santa?" And so I just, the letters and the questions to me are a metaphor for growing up, and that they are actually physical things that you can pull out of envelopes. Took a great deal of work on my editor, Arthur Levine's part and Scholastic. It was a tricky challenge, and I'm so thrilled that they did. And I do, because I also am a parent, I know those letters sometimes get lost. And so on my website, marthabrokenbro.com, there are downloadable replacements, so you can print them out for free at any point.
Wonderful idea. Let's talk for a moment about the visual beauty of this book, even aside from these wonderful little actual letters that that are part of it. I mean now the illustrations of Lee White and the beautiful way in which those reflect this story and kind of the evolving timeline of this young girl named Lucy. Explain what the collaboration was between the two of you and how this book ultimately took shape.
Lee White lives in Portland, Oregon, and I live in Seattle, Washington. So these are, you know, we're kind of neighboring cities. We're just a few hours apart, and we met years ago at a conference for children's writers and illustrators, and I saw his artwork, and I immediately loved it. I think he's an absolute master of the beautiful and the bittersweet. And so, you know, this is one thing that a lot of people don't know about how picture books are made. Authors generally don't get to choose the people who illustrate. That's the job of the editor. You know, editors and art directors are actual, you know, experts in matching the text with just the right illustration. And they know, of course, many more illustrators than most authors do. But this is one of those cases. I sent my editor, Arthur Levine, some examples of Lee's work. And Arthur was very familiar with Lee and agreed that he could capture both the growing up of Lucy and the emotions of the parent and the child through this once-in-a-lifetime transition.
Mm. She really does. I mean, one of my favorite illustrations in the book is when Lucy is writing that final letter to Santa, really doubting what she once believed about who Santa was. And the look on young Lucy's face is really priceless and really helps us remember that for a youngster, this can be a very disconcerting moment in their life, this moment when they, in a sense, begin to doubt all of their assumptions about Santa.
Well, it can be a disconcerting moment. You know, your parents have told you, and everyone around you, the world has told you that there is this character named Santa, and why would people tell you something that's not true? And I know that some people who don't want any part of this, you know, view it as lying to children. And for me, it's telling a story, and stories have purpose. And the purpose of this story is to build the capacity for faith in goodness and in the goodness of ourselves to create magic and joy and wonder for other people.
Mm. This book, again, is Love Santa, When You're Ready to Share the Beautiful Truth About Santa, published by Scholastic. Martha Brokenbrough, in our last minute, would you just say a quick word about something that you created called National Grammar Day, which happens every March 4th? What is National Grammar Day about?
National Grammar Day is about celebrating our love of language and our care for it so that we can communicate clearly and effectively with each other, not only so that we can be understood, but so that we can understand people. It's kind of like, you know, we have a certain set of rules for the game of basketball, and that's what makes it fun and fair. And we don't have quite the same rigid rule structure for language, but we can play with it as though we did. And this came out of an effort I had when I was a high school teacher. I wanted to have a fun way of talking with my kids about language. And so I invented a secret society, SPOG, the Society for the Promotion of Good Grammar. And SPOG would send sternly worded letters when the kids got something not quite right. And so the goal was to have a fun way of talking about language. And so, you know, we can eat grammar crackers, we can drink grammar teenies, but the point is just to celebrate language, which is the bonds between us as people, and let us make those bonds strong and clear and loving and supportive.
There's lots of interesting things on Martha Brokenbrough's website, and again, her latest book is called Love Santa. Martha Brokenbrough, very best wishes. It was great to talk with you today. Happy holidays to you and everyone you care about.
Thank you so much.
It's 8:31, and you're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. That music is, of course, from George Frideric Handel's towering masterpiece, Messiah, the greatest of all oratorios. And this wonderful work can be experienced this Sunday evening at 6 p.m. in the annual Sing-Along Messiah at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. This is part of the concert series known as Fine Arts at First. And Jessica DeBoer, who is the coordinator, or well, you have a fancier title.
Oh, no, just That's fine. Coordinator, director, impresario.
There you go. Whatever you like. Jessica DeBoer is the brains and the muscle behind Fine Arts at First, and presiding over this performance that will be happening on Sunday evening, a sing-along Messiah in which the audience, or at least the vast majority of the audience, serves as the chorus, singing the choruses of this amazing work to the accompaniment of full orchestra and with really fine soloists on hand, along with two really good groups that are going to offer up a prelude. So it should be a really wonderful night. And I'm really happy that Jessica DeBoer, in the midst of quite a busy week, is making time to chat a little bit about the Sing-Along Messiah again. Sunday evening, 6 p.m. Jessica, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Give us a quick rundown, first of all, of what has happened thus far with Fine Arts at First, with this current season leading up to Messiah.
Sure. We had in September, we had Ross Salvosa, a piano soloist, do a recital, which was unbelievable. Every concert, people come up and say, oh, that was such a great concert. And I don't think I had more people come up to me after that concert than I think I've ever had. Hmm. And so that was really a wonderful way to start off the season. And then in November, we had the Bell Ensemble doing a concert of music by Britten and Barber, mystical, it was called Musical Mystics. Hmm. So it was all religious music done by those two composers who are contemporaries. So that was a lovely concert. And now we're up to Messiah. We're about to the halfway point of the season. So. Hmm. It's exciting. I can't believe it's here already.
Right. So this is something you've been doing for a long, long time.
This is our 13th annual Messiah. So, but for me, it's my 12th. I only missed the first one because we had just moved to town that fall. And so I didn't even know it was a thing. So, but ever since then.
Yeah. Well, now you know it's a thing.
I know it is totally a thing.
So explain to our listeners what happens behind the scenes, particularly as far as you're concerned, in terms of making this particular performance happen.
Sure. We have a full orchestra for this program, and it's about 30 people. And so, you know, my biggest part of my job is hiring the orchestra and making sure that everybody's all set with all of their needs, getting their music, things like that. But, you know, actually that part's really easy because everybody who plays in this concert loves it. And every year I send out an email saying, hey, it's time for Messiah. Can you play this year? And almost every single person replies, oh, of course, I'm so excited. It's my favorite concert. I can't wait. Or they reply saying, oh, darn it, I have to go to a party that night and I can't. I'm so
or
sad.
Or play a Nutcracker that
right.
afternoon.
Right, oh, Nutcracker, yeah. So, you know, it's actually kind of easy to get the orchestra set up because they love to come. And it really is so much fun. But then, you know, there's all the promotion that happens, the posters and the newspaper write-ups and things like that that have to go out. But really, you know, most of the work happens the day of, getting it set up and getting all the chairs and stands out, all the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts stage work. So that's really the biggest part.
Right. People should understand that, of course, a nearly complete Messiah was just performed will be two weekends ago.
Yes.
At the University of Wisconsin Parkside.
Right.
And of course that's one way and really the purest way to experience this work mm-hmm. is as an audience member sitting and listening to a carefully polished and prepared choir singing
yes.
the choruses and soloists and so on, and this wonderful performance under Dr. Kinchin at Parkside that has become its own lovely tradition, although I don't think they do it every year.
They do it every 3 years.
Every 3 years. So this is sort of a different kind of tradition, and it's one that isn't unique to Kenosha. Sing-along Messiahs have been happening for quite a long time.
That's true. But it is it's definitely more hands-on, and we need the audience to do the choral pieces. Although, if you are nervous about that, I don't want you to think, oh, I have to come and sing and I can't sing. Nope, there's plenty of seating for people who just want to sit and listen. So don't feel obliged to sing. It's not a requirement. You just come and enjoy, for sure.
There is, of course, the matter of music, and some people, but by no means do all people, own their own copy of Messiah, and you have that covered
That's
too.
That's true, we do. We have program books there, or choral books anyway, And they have all the choruses in there. So if you don't have music, you don't have to worry. Just come and we'll loan you a book for the evening. And then you can use that and then turn it back in. And then you don't have to worry about bringing your own music. But if you have your own favorite score that you love that was, you know, that you've been using forever, bring that too. That's just fine.
Do you have a sense of who comes to this in terms of how far a distance? It's certainly from time to time I get a sense that there are people who are not just coming from up the street.
Right. There are people that have been coming from Milwaukee saying, we used to do this sing-along and they don't do it anymore. So we had to, you know, we're so happy to find one. And we've, you know, I've had people come from all over saying, oh, we don't do this in our area. So I'm glad that you do. And I know that every year that there are people that come every year. Certain, you know, audience members are there every year and we are so grateful for them. But then every year too, we have people show up and say, I never knew this was here. I'm so excited to have, you know, to know that this is here. And then they come and that becomes a part of their tradition. So, you know, it's wonderful to have such a core group, but also new people every year that have never been before.
So tell us about your own personal history with Messiah, even ahead of these sing-along Messiahs that you helped put together.
Oh, man. I did a full Messiah when I was in college with a local church back in the town where I went to school, and they did a, you know, they did it with the Christmas part at Christmas, and then they did the Easter part at Easter. And so before I started playing with this group, you know, you do a movement here at a symphony concert, you do the Hallelujah Chorus at Easter time sometimes, and, you know, but really, I hadn't played it a whole lot, and we don't do the whole thing, but, you know, it's just been such a wonderful concert to look forward to every year for me. I love playing it. I love the viola part. It's so interesting compared to a lot of Baroque viola parts. You know, a lot of times we get the leftover notes that nobody really wants to play, but not true for Handel. We get really interesting things to play. So for me personally, it's such a fun concert to play. Really wonderful music that you don't always get to play very often.
Right.
Except for the Hallelujah Chorus. You play that a lot.
Right, right. Yeah, I suppose you know that one just about by heart.
Just about.
We should sample a couple of things from the score that are especially wonderful. And I asked you just before we went on the air if there is a particular movement from Messiah that you especially love and maybe are especially looking forward to.
I am very excited that this year we have brought back the bass aria, The People That Walked in Darkness. And it is a beautiful melody that's really complex, and selfishly, the viola part is really exciting and fun to play. And we haven't done this movement for several years. And so I'm really, when you sent me the list of who's singing what, I was very excited to see this movement back on the roster for this year because we haven't done it for a while and it's my favorite movement to play.
Mm. So we should maybe just ahead of listening to a little bit, this would be a piece that's definitely Advent.
Yes.
It's really in that Advent spirit of kind of waiting and
the
trying
to
be patient.
The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light.
Right. And so the recitative in particular, For Behold, Darkness Shall Cover the Earth, is a very kind of ominous sounding thing, a real air of kind of mystery. And the writing of for the orchestra is so atmospheric, and then the vocal line of the bass is just so stark and haunting.
Yes.
It's really, really an amazing movement. And so let's hear the recit and at least a little bit of the aria that follows it. This is the great Welsh bass Gwyn Howell on the recording that was conducted by the great Sir Georg Scholti. So here is a little bit of this favorite movement of Jessica DeBoer.
Excellent.
From the first part of Handel's Messiah.
Behold!
Just a bit of this beautiful bass aria from Handel's Messiah. This is from the first part, or part the first, I think, is
part
actually
first, yes.
Technically what it says in the score. The people that walked in darkness, which is going to be back. I might as well mention that probably my favorite movement from Messiah is what follows this aria, which is, I think, the single most exultant of all of the choruses which are in this score, For Unto Us a Child is Born. And this is also an instance in which, at least for the most part, it works wonderfully to have a church full of singers to render the big exultant climaxes with wonderful counselor. It's just absolutely thrilling. So here's a little of that chorus from Handel's Messiah.
Unto us a son is given, for unto
Ah, that is a tricky chorus, but so much fun. For unto us a child is born, from the Christmas portion of Handel's Messiah. And this is probably as good a time as any to mention sort of the part of Messiah that we are doing, the fact that this is not complete, but what has been done has varied quite a lot over the years.
Yeah, Messiah comes in three parts. Originally, and I was just looking up some information about it on Wikipedia last night to refresh my memory, and it says there's 53 movements in Messiah. I thought that, wow, that's so many. Don't worry, we're not doing all 53, so you won't have to sit through all of them. But we do most of the Christmas portion, which is the first part, and then we do some of the movements from the second part, which is about Christ's death and resurrection. So, but most of it is, you know, the stories from the Gospels of the birth of Christ and from Isaiah waiting for the coming of Christ. So that's the majority of what we do. And, of course, we end with the Hallelujah Chorus. So we can't forget that one.
Right. There have been years where we limited ourselves to the Christmas portion. In fact, I feel like when the first one that I conducted, it pretty much was the Christmas portion plus the Hallelujah Chorus. You kind of wait to see how that goes. But really, it's a mistake to peg this work as specifically Christmas. Its first performance was in the Easter season when it was first done. And most of the work is actually not about Christmas at all. But, of course, the parts we probably know the best and maybe even love the most are from that opening
first part.
Yeah. And it really is amazing the way even these pieces of music just flow one into the other with this beautiful sense of continuity. So
yes, and you know, it's over the years we've sort of come up with a list of pieces that we do that really works well, and in the last 4 or 5 years we've sort of settled into this grouping of pieces with a couple that switch around here and there, but for the most part now we have this really established group of works that we do for our Messiah, and I think it works really well.
Yeah,
it's a nice amount.
Absolutely. We should mention that we have a really fine lineup of soloists, three of whom have strong connection to Carthage and are former voice students of mine, and all three have been past soloists for this event: soprano Mary Catherine Bach, and tenor Nick Huff, and bass Mike Anderley are all absolutely first rate, and that's quite exciting. And Libby Weisinger, who is a member of First United Methodist, has anchored the alto solos the entire time that this work has been done.
Yep, so I think she's one of the few that have been there for every performance.
Absolutely. So, and we are very, very happy to have her. And so that is the lineup of soloists. And I'm also happy to say that offering up a prelude just ahead of the Messiah starting will be two different groups with which I'm affiliated. First of all, my current Lincoln Chamber Singers at Carthage, so 16 of the very best singers at Carthage right now, and then a group called Musici Amici, which means musical friends, and they are all alums of the Chamber Singers who live here in the area, and each time we get together to perform for something, it's always a slightly different array of singers, but really, really fine musicians who've often been a part of these Messiah performances.
They've done so many preludes, and they're always so lovely.
So we'll actually have both groups on hand, and they'll be sticking around to help lead the actual performance then itself. And Jessica, I think you should say a quick word about the quality of the orchestra that will be accompanying the proceedings and who these men and women are.
Sure. The members of the orchestra are mainly local. We have a few that come from the Chicago area and a few that come from Milwaukee, but most of them are from the Racine Kenosha environs, and they are all professionals who play in the Kenosha Symphony, the Racine Symphony. They are professors at colleges. They are retired teachers. They are all fantastic musicians who come from our area, and they are all so excited to play this concert, which makes it even better, you know, something we all look forward to. And so they are just a wonderful bunch of performers. And I'm just so grateful to them for coming each year because it makes the performance so wonderful to have such talented people playing.
Oh, that makes all the difference in the world.
Yes.
It really, really does. So explain what people should do, what
yes.
they should plan on doing if they want to come be a part of the Sing Along Messiah Sunday night.
Absolutely. Our programs, every program at Fine Arts at First is completely free. There's no tickets. There's no admission price. You just come and enjoy. We open the doors. The performance starts at 6. We open the doors at 5:30. So that's when you can start entering the sanctuary. There will be ushers that can loan you a music book if you want one. Or if you don't want one, you can sit up in the balcony and listen. And then you just come and enjoy and sing and enjoy the beautiful setting and the wonderful music. And we do take a free will offering to help defray the costs, but there are no tickets, so it's open for everybody.
And usually cookies afterwards.
And there, how could I forget the cookies? There are cookies afterward for sure. Cannot forget the cookies.
And it looks like Mother Nature is cooperating. She didn't cooperate so well last year.
No, last year it was like high of minus 10. It was horrible. It was
extremely
so cold.
Cold.
It was very cold. And
we still had a few people that braved the elements.
Stalwart Wisconsinites came anyway. But yeah, we've had years past where it was snowing like crazy and we've had freezing cold, but this year it looks great. You know, highs in the 40s that day. So I'm really grateful for that because the weather can make a big difference.
Hmm. So Sunday evening at 6 p.m., doors open at 5:30 for the 13th Annual Sing-Along Messiah at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha. That's at the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street, a beautiful place to make music, a beautiful place to experience music. And this is part of the Fine Arts at First series, coordinated by Jessica DeBoer. Jessica, great to have you here. I look forward to Sunday night very much, and thanks for being part of today's morning show.
Thank you. See you Sunday.
And here is just a little bit of that famous chorus with which one could scarcely even imagine performing Handel's Messiah. This is the exultant chorus that finishes out the second portion, the Hallelujah chorus. The Sing Along Messiah at First United Methodist will be Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Also this weekend, and this is just a partial list of the other things going on, there are three performances of excerpts from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Ballet, Saturday afternoon and Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon at the ComArts Theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, presented by the Studio of Classical Dance Arts. And you can go to classicaldancearts.com for more information. And Saturday night at 7 p.m. at Carthage in Siebert Chapel, it is the annual Kenosha Pops Band's Christmas.